Hello, listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk. I'm Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Ray Goodwin.
And today we're bringing you Episode 10, the Mealtime Conversations at Fuhrer Headquarters that took place from October 18th to October 22nd, 1941. They were taken down in a kind of shorthand by Heinrich Heim at Martin Bormann's request with Adolf Hitler's permission. Right after the group dispersed, Heim typed up his notes into the form we see it today. So, Ray, we're ready we're already on episode 10, just think. You were saying before we started, before we came on air, that you thought they just keep getting better.
That is exactly right. It seems to be just a whole lot more power and meat in each of these lessons as we go from one to the next.
Yeah. Well, I agree, and I'm just really loving it. So we are starting on October 18th today, and there is a timeline activity from the war. On the 18th, the Red Army troop reinforcements arrive in Moscow from Siberia because Stalin was assured that the Japanese will not attack the USSR from the east. Now, this is really important, and it's a turning point in the war. Not that I'm a war expert, but a military expert, but it seems to me it was, and this is one of the worst things that happened in the entire Barbarossa campaign, because Hitler was hoping, tell me if you disagree with me on any of this, Ray, Hitler was hoping that Stalin would be keeping his troops in the east to protect from any kind of an attack from Japan, but this... One person who played a big part in this was the Soviet spy Richard Sorge, who is regarded as one of the most successful spies of World War II. He was working for the Soviets. He was a German. He wasn't actually a German, but he was thought to be a German. Well, let me tell you about this man. Anyway, he had found out, and he passed on to Stalin that the Japanese were not going to attack Russia at all, that they were heading, they had made the decision to turn to the south and to go into Singapore and so on as the better strategy for themselves. They really had no appetite to take on Russia either. And so because of that, Stalin moved all of his best troops from the east over to the Western Front, and that's why Moscow was better defended than it would have been otherwise, by far better defended, and lots of other places too. And so that's why things did not go the way they had hoped they would, the way they planned. But this Richard Sorge was I looked him up, you know. He was born in Azerbaijan, which is like south of Russia, east of Georgia and Armenia, down in the Caucasus, and he was though raised in Germany, and he served in the German army during World War I. And during his convalescence from injuries suffered in that war, he became a communist, and he fled to Moscow, and he was recruited as a spy for the Soviet Union. So using the cover of a journalist, which is what most of them seem to do, because I was reading about some other British Soviet spies yesterday, and they were all working as journalists. Sorge was sent to various Eastern European countries to assess the possibility of communist uprisings. See, that's what they were doing. They were trying to have communist uprisings everywhere, right? And I think Russia is still involved in wanting to have uprisings, but that's a whole other story. Anyway, after going around and learning a lot of things, he became a German journalist because he had that connection, and he went to Tokyo to do his journalism, and there he was supposedly a German, but he was transmitting intelligence to the Soviet Union, and a staggering amount of intelligence, they say, he got, and one of them was this, he had the exact launch date of Operation Barbarossa, but the Stalin didn't believe him. And so he didn't prepare for it. And that was one of his big mistakes. Lots of these leaders make a lot of big mistakes, and not just Hitler making mistakes, if people like to point out. But the most significant thing was that he was able to tell Stalin that the Japanese had no plans to join the German attack on the Soviet Union, and that helped Stalin greatly. So I won't go into any more details about that, but this leads me to tell you, listeners, that I have scheduled this show tonight for 90 minutes instead of 60 minutes. That's why I'm taking my time with this little timeline story. Just not that we will go 90 minutes, but just so that we don't have to be cut off and have the problem of whether to play the outro music or to have things go, the live listeners not hearing the rest of the show if we go over. So I've just scheduled it for 90 minutes, and we will end the show whenever at 60 minutes or anytime after that, whenever it is works out best for us. So just so you know that. Okay, so we start out now, and we have interesting guests again.
Sure. Uh-huh. I would like to comment on what you just said about Sergei and the Japanese making that decision that they were going into Southeast Asia and Singapore and that area, and they did not want to stir up anything with Russia. That was a huge strategic mistake on their part, as well as hurting their ally.
Uh-huh.
Because, as you said, it allowed troops to be freed up, some of the most experienced and toughest troops, to be thrown against the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
And Japan was looking out strictly for its own interests. But what that did was to bog Germany down. And if on the other hand, the Japanese had decided to assist their ally by hitting Russia from the east and occupying those troops, then Germany would, in my mind, undoubtedly have been successful in taking Moscow, and may even have had the USSR suing for peace.
Mm-hmm.
And
they would certainly been on the run, that's for sure. I mean, that would have been
sure. And what that would have forced the United States to do would be to throw even more than they did anyway at Germany, our military might of all kinds and everything like this, which would have reduced the pressure even mm-hmm. further on the Japanese in the Pacific theater. So in my mind, the Japanese did make a very strategic mistake in not helping their ally at that strategic point, too.
Well, then I've said that I don't think that Germany and Japan were close allies in the same sense that Germany was with Italy and his relationship with Mussolini. And I don't know that they ever met together, or it was kind of a convenient, they were both fighting against the same group of people. Mm-hmm. And so they formed this axis. But I don't think that there was a close association between Hitler and and who's the emperor there, Hirohito. Or Tojo or whoever.
Yeah. That's a good point. And the Japanese were number one. I mean, they were looking out for number one. That was it primarily. They figured Germany could take care of themselves, and they would certainly start trying to establish their economic sphere and military sphere in the Far East.
Yeah.
And that was their goal.
Yeah. So when we talk about them as being allies, or in the sense that they should have been working together, I don't think that was actually going on. And then Mussolini didn't do such a great job of working together either.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we don't want to get bogged down to that. So if you're ready to start reading, well, we have a special guest here.
Yeah, our special guest here, October 18th, 1941, in the evening, Professor Speer and Professor Brecker.
And of course, Brecker is the famous artist, Arno Brecker.
Uh-huh.
And Speer is the famous architect, Albert, yes. Isn't it? Albert Speer.
That's right.
Speer. Uh-huh. And so they, he had them there for that day, for whatever reason, or they were visiting.
Right. Okay. Hitler says, "It's a queer business how England slipped into the war. The man who managed it was Churchill, that puppet of the Jewry that pulls the strings. Next to him, the bumptious Eden, a money-grubbing clown. The Jew who was Minister for War, Hor Belisha, and then the Eminence Greasy of the Foreign Office, and after that, some other Jews and businessmen. With these last, it often happens that the size of their fortune is an inverse ratio to the size of their brains. Before the war even began, somebody managed to persuade them that it would last at least 3 years and would therefore be a good investment for them. The people, which has the privilege of possessing such a government, was not asked for its opinion. The business world is made up everywhere of the same rogues, cold-hearted money grubbers. The business world gets idealistic only when the workers ask for higher wages. I fully realize that with us, too, the possibilities for people of that kind were greater before 1933. But let the businessmen weep. It's part of their trade. I've never met an industrialist without observing how he puts on a careworn expression. Yet it's not difficult to convince each one of them that he has regularly improved his position. One always sees them panting as if they were on the point of giving up their last gasp. Despite all the taxes, there's a lot of money left. Even the average man doesn't succeed in spending what he earns. He spends more money on cinemas, theaters, and concerts than he used to, and he saves money into the bargain. One can't deprive people of distractions. They need them, and that's why I cannot reduce the activity of the theaters and studios. The best relaxation is that provided by the theater and the cinema. We have working days that far exceed 8 hours, and we shan't be able to change that immediately after the war. A fault we must never again commit is to forget, once the war is over, the advantages of the autarkic economy. We practiced it during the First World War, but with insufficient means, for lack of human potential. The working capacity lost in the manufacture of unproductive goods must be made good. Instead of thinking of the home market, we hurled ourselves into the foreign markets. Before the First World War, out of greed for profits, and after it, to pay our debts. The fact that we were granted loans to encourage us along the same path only plunged us deeper in the mire. We'd already succeeded in the manufacture of synthetic rubber. As soon as the war was over, we went back to natural rubber. We imported petrol. Yes, the Burgess.
Yet the
Burgess process had already proved itself. That's our most urgent task for the post-war period, to build up the autarkic economy. I shall retain rationing of meat and fats as long as I'm not certain that people's needs are largely covered. One realizes that this stage has been reached when the rationing coupons are not all used. What the English were most afraid of with the four-year plan was an autarkic Germany that they could no longer have at their mercy. Such a policy on our part necessarily entailed for them a great reduction in the profits of their colonies. Coffee and tea are all we shall have to import. Tobacco we shall get in Europe. It will also be necessary to produce the soya bean. That will provide oil and fodder for Denmark and Holland. Everybody will be able to participate under one form or another in this European economy. If it were only a question of conquering a colony, I would not continue the war a day longer. For a colonial policy to have any sense, one must first dominate Europe. In any case, the only colony I'd like to have back would be our Cameroons, nothing else.
Yeah, boy, he goes from one thing to another there.
Yeah.
He's so excited about this economic development. You know, he just keeps coming back to that. And when he says for a colonial policy to have any sense, one must first dominate Europe, meaning, in my estimation, meaning that Europe is the most important. You know, Europe is most important, and having dominating places outside of Europe, like in the Cameroon, say, like he liked that, or you know, in Africa or any kind of colonies, that's much less important. And he really wasn't that interested in colonies far away. He wanted things to be contiguous. He liked having it all in one big vast land mass that you could drive around in and travel around in, not where you had to fly to other parts of the world or go on sailing ships there.
Well, by I think the phrase he used, by dominating Europe, he means uniting it, and that makes the whole thing that makes autarky possible, because you have all these European nations that can contribute different things and help each other and don't have to rely on colonies and things like this. So, you know, the goal mm-hmm. of dominating Europe and interlocking all these different nations with their strengths, whether one might be agricultural, manufacturing, anything like that. And once you get a big unit like that, and not just one nation of Germany being an autarky, but the entirety of Europe, then you have a powerful economic unit.
Okay, yeah, very good. Very good. I agree with that. That's right. I was thinking, I guess I'll bring it up here. Someone had written in a comment, not to me, but somewhere else, but about, they were talking about table talk, and they were talking about, you know, Christianity and so on, and said that they commented that Hitler, in their mind, in their estimation, Hitler had been a devout Christian his entire life. And I found that so very amazing. And here he's talking, he's so concerned with goods and food and the material needs that peoples have and so on. And I think that if he were, and he always was, you know, and if he were a devout Christian, he wouldn't be concerned with that most of all. He would be concerned with more spiritual things. And I think of the Bible verse on look at the flowers of the field. They don't spin, they don't work, and yet they're arrayed in such glory. And so don't worry about what you're going to eat, what you're going to wear, and so on, because everything will be provided. You know, I think this is a sign right here that Hitler was a practical, materialistic, if you can say that. You know, he wasn't really a materialist, but still, what would you call that? You know, practical thinking man about this world and cared about this world. And how the experiences people had in this world, and not that kind of a Christian where he'd be mostly concerned with the other worlds, the next world to come.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So I just made that note for myself there. So I just thought I'd
sure.
Say
and, you
it
know,
then.
The God will provide syndrome.
Yeah, he didn't depend on that.
No, that's exactly right. He was more along the lines of God helps those who help themselves.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that would really be it too, because he did talk about providence, and he did believe in the world beyond, in things beyond this world, but that you had to do everything you could here. So, all right, well, we'll go on. Now we're on to the 19th, and there's another timeline thing. On the 19th, an official state of siege is announced in Moscow, and the city is placed under martial law. So the as we talked about last week, the move on Moscow's had been made, and Moscow was under attack, and so they were defending themselves. And on the 19th, there's this little item that German occupied Luxembourg was declared Judenrein, Jew free, cleansed of Jews. So they this is mostly from Wikipedia, and they've got more interest in the World War II timeline in Wikipedia about the Jews. Is there everything about the Jews they have in there? So, but at least this was something that was going on at this time in German occupied European states. Okay. This is a good one.
Oh, yeah.
Large families.
Oh, yeah. October 19th, 1941. The essential thing for the future is to have lots of children. Everybody should be persuaded that a family's life is assured only when it has upwards of four children. I should even say four sons. That's a principle that should never be forgotten. When I learn that a family has lost two sons at the front, I intervene immediately. If we had practiced the system of two-children families in the old days, Germany would have been deprived of her greatest geniuses. How does it come about that the exceptional being in a family is often the fifth, seventh, tenth, or twelfth in a row?
Yeah, well, you know, I've heard him talk like that before.
Yes.
So here he's just saying this again in some part of the evening, right, or the midday, maybe. He's bringing that up again. Why it's important to have enough children.
Sure. And then you have 19th of October, 1941, evening. The art of building is one of the most ancient of human trades. That explains why, in this trade more than any other, people have remained faithful to traditional methods. It's a sphere in which we are terribly behind. To build a house should not necessarily consist in anything more than assembling the materials, which would not necessarily entail a uniformity of dwellings. The disposition and number of elements can be varied, but the elements should be standardized. Whoever wants to do more than is necessary will know what it costs him. A Croesus is not looking for the three-room dwelling at the lowest price. What's the point of having 100 different models for wash basins? Why these differences in the dimensions of windows and doors? You change your apartment and your curtains are no longer any use to you. For my car, I can find spare parts everywhere, but not for my apartment. These practices exist only because they give shopkeepers a chance of making more money. That's the only explanation of this infinite variety. In a year or two from now, this scandal must have been put a stop to. It's the same with the differences of voltage in the supply of electricity. For example, Moabit and Charlottenburg have different...
I think that's Moabit. I looked that up.
Oh, okay. Moabit? Okay. Uh-huh. Have different currents. When we rebuild the Reich, we'll make all of that uniform. Likewise, in the field of construction, we shall have to modernize the tools. The excavator that's still in use is a prehistoric monster compared to the new spiral excavator. What economies one could achieve by standardization in this field. The wish we have to give millions of Germans better living conditions forces us to standardization, and thus to make use of elements built to a norm wherever there is no necessity for individual forms. If we make things uniform, the masses will be able to enjoy the material amenities of life. With a market of 15 million purchasers, it's quite conceivable that it would be possible to build a cheap radio set and a popular typewriter. I find it a real absurdity that even today a typewriter costs several hundred marks. One can imagine the time wasted daily in deciphering everybody's scribbles. Why not give lessons in typewriting at primary school? Instead of religious instruction, for example. I shouldn't mind that.
Yeah, you know, two things he says here are just so typical of the way he thinks about things and the way any ordinary person does. Like, he says he just can't imagine how much time people have to waste trying to figure out somebody's handwriting when, people could have typewriters and use that. You wouldn't have to. And, you know, that's just so it's so down to earth. And the other thing is the curtains, because I've had that experience myself. He says you change your apartment and your curtains are no longer any use to him, mm-hmm. no longer any use to you. Well, he must have had this experience, or he wouldn't be able to say that, right?
That's right.
I mean, he lived in a few different places, and he was not a spendthrift, and he was careful, lived as frugally as possible. And so he moves. He takes the curtains, and they don't fit the windows. One time, I know a long time ago, I was in this new apartment, and I had been given this this fabric, and there was a nice sunroom in the back, and it had all these windows. I spent all this time sewing these curtains with this nice, beautiful fabric for these windows, and like drapes, and you could open them and close them. And then a year later, I had to move, and they were, and I thought, you know, I took them with me, of course, and they wouldn't fit anything because they were too short. And it's curtains are really unusual that way. It's not that easy to move them from one place to another. So I just thought that was kind of a very, very revealing that he would think about that.
Well, it revealed to me even more his forward thinking about standardization. And having taught American history in the post-World War II period, the big boom and building and people moving to suburbia, what that was about, of course, was standardization. They may call them cookie-cutter homes and things like this when they established Levittown, Pennsylvania. There were several Levitt towns, but what that did was exactly what Hitler says here. If we make things uniform, the masses will be able to enjoy the material amenities of life. And so these homes, once they had everything standardized in them, the price, you didn't have to pay for individual lists, this pick that, and it became more of a bargain for people. And here's Adolf Hitler talking about this in 1941, and you
right.
know, and then it hit. This is exactly what the United States went to after World War II, and particularly in the early 1950s and throughout the 50s.
Well, it seems like Hitler had all the good ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And there was nothing that was done that he hadn't already thought about and talked about if he hadn't put it into place himself.
Right.
And then everybody was using it. And at the same time, trying to call him the most evil person that ever lived. It's just so amazing, the discrepancies about this man. And it's just amazing. But
yeah. And this next little bit, Carolyn, is quite brief, but so powerful.
And here we're going to go and offend the Christians again.
Yeah. Well.
And then the next one is too.
Oh, yeah.
Which is longer. So
yeah,
I'm glad you're going to read this.
Sure, I'm fine with that. 19th of October, 1941, night. The reason why the ancient world was so pure, light, and serene was that it knew nothing of the two great scourges, the pox and Christianity. Christianity is a prototype of Bolshevism, the mobilization by the Jews of the masses of slaves with the object of undermining society. Thus one understands that the healthy elements of the Roman world were proof against this doctrine. Yet Rome today allows itself to reproach Bolshevism with having destroyed the Christian churches, as if Christianity hadn't behaved in the same way toward the pagan temples.
Well, right, and you know, you can't object to that because Christianity did do that, did destroy all the pagan temples, and did do everything they could to stamp out these people's religion.
And not just their religion, but the people themselves.
If
they refused to convert, they were slaughtered right and left.
I know. It was a horrible thing, really horrible. They thought they had the right and the need to do it. Now that's all forgotten, and these same and the not the ancestors, the other, the progeny of these people are now, became devoted Christians. But, you know, that's, it's what you, everybody's done it, you know, to mm-hmm. Everybody's done the same thing. Well, we're going on to the next, there's timeline here for October 20th and 21st, I added. I put the 20th in here because there is no 20th. But because we're going on to the 21st. But on the 20th, Lieutenant Colonel Fritz Hotz, the German commander in Nantes, that's in France, is killed by, I think that's in the southern part of France, which was not occupied by the Germans, is killed by the resistance. 50 hostages are shot in reprisal, and the incident will become a model for future occupation policies. This is one of the first ones, I guess, in which in which a high-level German commander is killed by the resistance, and they do a reprisal action, and they took 50 of them in this case, which seemed to be a number that was used a lot afterwards. I think it's justified myself. But anyway, October 21st, because there's no way you're going to stop these people except if you do some pretty severe punishment.
That's right.
That's the basis that it's done on. Okay, October 21st, we have New Zealand troops landing in Egypt, and they take over Fort Capuzzo, which doesn't have anything really direct, but, you know, it just shows things that are going on, and Hitler has to be aware of it all. So New Zealand now is joining in, and negotiations in Washington between the United States and Japan seem headed toward failure. And, you know, this is 41 October, so we know what happened in December, December 7th, 1941. So.
Yeah, that was only 6 weeks away, 7 weeks. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So, okay, 21st of October, 1941, midday. When one thinks of the opinions held concerning Christianity by our best minds 100, 200 years ago, one is ashamed to realize how little we have since evolved. I didn't know that Julian the Apostate had passed judgment with such clear-sightedness on Christianity and Christians. You should read what he says on the subject. Originally, Christianity was merely an incarnation of Bolshevism, the destroyer. Nevertheless, the Galilean, who later was called the Christ, intended something quite different. He must be regarded as a popular leader who took up his position against Jewry. Galilee was a colony where the Romans had probably installed Gallic legionaries, and it's certain that Jesus was not a Jew. The Jews, by the way, regarded him as the son of a whore. Of a whore and a Roman soldier. The decisive falsification of Jesus' doctrine was the work of St. Paul. He gave himself to this work with a subtlety and for purposes of personal exploitation. For the Galilean's object was to liberate his country from Jewish oppression. He set himself against Jewish capitalism, and that's why the Jews liquidated him.
You know, I think this is in a way... Hitler is identifying with Jesus,
yes, yes.
Very much, and he always saw him he liked seeing him as a fighter against Jewry. He could see him in that way and hold him in high esteem.
That's exactly right.
For that reason, yeah, okay.
Paul of Tarsus, his name was Saul before the road to Damascus, was one of those who persecuted Jesus most savagely. When he learned that Jesus' supporters let their throats be cut for his ideas, he realized that by making intelligent use of the Galileans' teaching, it would be possible to overthrow this Roman state, which the Jews hated. It's in this context that we must understand the famous illumination. Think of it. The Romans were daring to confiscate the most sacred thing the Jews possessed, the gold piled up in their temples. At that time, as now, money was their god. On the road to Damascus, St. Paul discovered that he could succeed in ruining the Roman state by causing the principle to triumph of the equality of all men before a single god, and by putting beyond the reach of the laws his private notions, which he alleged to be divinely inspired. If, into the bargain, one succeeded in imposing one man as the representative on earth of the only god, that man would possess boundless power. The ancient world had its gods and served them, but the priests interposed between the gods and men were servants of the state, for the gods protected the city. In short, they were the emanation of a power that the people had created. For that society, the idea of an only god was unthinkable. In this sphere, the Romans were tolerance itself. The idea of a universal God could seem to them only a mild form of madness, for if three peoples fight one another, each invoking the same God, this means that, at any rate, two of them are praying in vain. Nobody was more tolerant than the Romans. Every man could pray to the God of his choice, and a place was even reserved in the temples for the unknown God. Moreover, every man prayed as he chose and had the right to proclaim his preferences. St. Paul knew how to exploit this state of affairs in order to conduct his struggle against the Roman state. Nothing has changed. The method has remained sound. Under cover of a pretended religious instruction, the priests continue to incite the faithful against the state. The religious ideas of the Romans are common to all Aryan peoples. The Jew, on the other hand, worshipped and continues to worship, then and now, nothing but the golden calf. The Jewish religion is devoid of all metaphysics and has no foundation but the most repulsive materialism. That's proved even in the concrete representation they have of the beyond, which for them is identified with Abraham's bosom. It's since St. Paul's time that the Jews have manifested themselves as a religious community, for until then, they were only a racial community. St. Paul was the first man to take account of the possible advantages of using a religion as a means of propaganda. If the Jew had succeeded in destroying the Roman Empire, that's That's because St. Paul transformed a local movement of Aryan opposition to Jewry into a supratemporal religion which postulates the equality of all men amongst themselves and their obedience to an only God. This is what caused the death of the Roman Empire. It's striking to observe that Christian ideas, despite all St. Paul's efforts, had no success in Athens. The philosophy of the Greeks was so much superior to this poverty-stricken rubbish that the Athenians burst out laughing when they listened to the apostles' teaching. But in Rome, St. Paul found the ground prepared for him. His egalitarian theories had what was needed to win over a mass composed of innumerable uprooted people. Nevertheless, the Roman slave was not at all what the expression encourages us to imagine today. In actual fact, the people concerned were prisoners of war, as we understand the term nowadays, of whom many had been freed and had the possibility of becoming citizens. And it was St. Paul who introduced this degrading overtone into the modern idea of Roman slaves. Think of the numerous Germanic people whom Rome welcomed. Arminius himself, the first architect of our liberty, wasn't he a Roman knight and his brother a dignitary of the state? By reason of these contacts renewed throughout the centuries, the population of Rome had ended by acquiring a great esteem for the Germanic peoples. It's clear that there was a preference in Rome for fair-haired women, to such a point that many Roman women dyed their hair. Thus, Germanic blood constantly regenerated Roman society. The Jew, on the other hand, was despised in Rome. Whilst Roman society proved hostile to the new doctrine, Christianity in its pure state stirred the population to revolt. Rome was Bolshevized, and Bolshevism produced exactly the same results in Rome as later in Russia. It was only later, under the influence of the Germanic spirit, that Christianity gradually lost its openly Bolshevistic character. It became, to a certain degree, tolerable. Today, when Christianity is tottering, the Jew restores to pride of place Christianity in its Bolshevistic form. The Jew believed he could renew the experiment. Today, as once before, the object is to destroy nations by vitiating their racial integrity. It's not by chance that the Jews in Russia have systematically deported hundreds of thousands of men, delivering the women, whom the men were compelled to leave behind, to males imported from other regions. They practiced on a vast scale the mixture of races. In the old days, as now, destruction of art and civilization. The Bolsheviks of their day, what they didn't destroy in Rome, in Greece, and elsewhere. What didn't they destroy? You know, they behaved in the same way amongst us and in Russia. One must compare the art and civilization of the Romans, their temples, their houses, with the art and civilization represented at the same period by the abject rabble of the catacombs. in the old days, the destruction of the libraries. Isn't that what happened in Russia? The result? A frightful leveling down. Didn't the world see, carried on right into the Middle Ages, the same old system of martyrs, torturers, faggots? Of old, it was in the name of Christianity. Today, it's in the name of Bolshevism. Yesterday, the instigator was Saul. The instigator today, Mordecai. Saul has changed into St. Paul, and Mordecai into Karl Marx. By exterminating this pest, we shall do humanity a service of which our soldiers can have no idea.
Wow.
Yep.
Wow.
That's exactly right.
Well, just even this last line here, he uses, or the translators are using the word exterminating this pest. But of course, I think it's even clear from just reading this that he just means let's get rid of these people. You know, he's not talking about actually, gas chambers and
right.
putting people to death. But, one thing that's also just, he just said that I'd like to bring up is that he uses the word faggots. I don't know what word he used, but they translated it as faggots. And I found that really surprising. It took me aback quite a bit that he is talking about the church people. The church stories from the Middle Ages, martyrs, torturers, and faggots. Maybe he was actually thinking about, had used some kind of a German slang word for homosexuals in terms of priests and so on. Because, of course, you have the martyrs and the tortures. People were being tortured. The Christians were being tortured and so on in those stories. What do you think? What do you make of that?
Well, like you, that grabbed me, too. I thought, whoa, here I was thinking this was a pretty modern word. And so, I feel like the way he meant it was exactly the way we mean it today. I mean, that's the way I took it to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's some surprises in here. You know, one thing he's talking, again, he goes into the race mixing thing with
yes.
the Jews. The Jews are the fathers and the creators of that. And it shows, again, that that was so important to him. And these people who are trying to change that, to say that, well, he wasn't that, you know, he changed his mind about race as time went on. He didn't. He didn't change it. And he spoke about it even in his political testament, his last, very last written words or dictated words. It was absolutely necessary in his mind that the races remain as pure as possible and we don't have a mixture in this way. And I think he even intended that to mean ethnicities that didn't fit together too well and things like that. It's not good to mix them up. Then I have to go back and look.
Well, he makes one very powerful point to me in pointing out Athens. And he's telling you that these egalitarian nonsense, these theories that are used to destroy and to manipulate, and this universal God thing, that kind of stuff made absolutely no impression at all in Athens. And why was that? Because the Athenians were a solid racial group, and you didn't have these, as he calls them, innumerable uprooted people from all over the world and all this stuff.
Yeah, they were taken as slaves.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, and you had Athens, which was racially unified and racially conscious of who they were, and it's interesting that none of this egalitarian mumbo jumbo made any progress at all with them, but it took root where you had what today would be called multiculturalism, and I think that's a very important point because so many nations of the world are being multicultural crunched and pushed into today, and that's part of the destruction of those countries.
Mm-hmm.
And and he's talking about it way back in Athens, and indicating that a strongly, a racially conscious and strongly united country on the basis of race can resist this stuff and it won't make any headway. But if your enemy's trying to conquer you through this mumbo jumbo, as I like to call it, then the best way to do it is to integrate your society and amalgamate a bunch of mixed races in it.
Right. And, you know, another thing that strikes me is that, yeah, he talks about the, he often brings up what he, the tolerance of the Romans. And it seems to me that he's kind of finding some fault with that, but also seeing that as a good point, because he himself was tolerant, particularly about religion. And I think he's talking here more about religion than anything else.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the Romans were tolerant of different religions, and Hitler wanted to be tolerant of religion because he doesn't like religious intolerance. He personally didn't like it. He doesn't approve of, that's one of his problems with the churches, mm-hmm. that they're so, and with Christianity, that it's so kind of intolerant. It used to be. Of course, it's
right.
It's wrong. It's tolerant in the wrong way now. Mm-hmm. And he wouldn't approve of the way it is now, because he totally disapproves of what Jewry is doing. He doesn't mean that to become tolerant in the way the Jews want Christianity to be tolerant. But anyway, this whole story that he gives, and I've read it in different versions from him in different places, that of how he thinks it all started out and how where he thinks Christianity came from, and his thinking about St. Paul and his thinking about how the church developed and so on, is he's basically telling this. He doesn't have the absolute last word on all this, but he's telling this to his German friends and associates that are close to him. He's just giving, you know, his version of how he thinks it could have been or might have been or would have been from his point of view. I don't see this as he's insisting that this is, you know, the absolute truth of it all. That's, mm-hmm. I don't get that impression.
No. What I liked about his telling us that Rome was the seat of religious tolerance, that you could pray to any god, and even certain temples would have room for the unknown god or whatever. And by taking that approach, what better way to nip in the bud any religious revolution or rebellion, because religious or rebellions based on religion are because the people feel offended or persecuted because of their religion. But if you're allowed to practice that religion openly and whatever it may be, the state's not going to bother you. Rome doesn't care. It keeps a cap on that religious need for a revolution. And you don't have any gripe. You can't complain because the state is allowing you to practice your religion.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it was a safety valve. Very useful to keep insurrection.
Well, that's right.
Insurrection
that's,
down.
That's really good, Ray, because I was also wanting to say that Hitler, you know, when it came to religion and the state, the government of the state, he preferred the state absolutely, mm-hmm. and he didn't want a religion to rule and religion. When it's organized and say Christianity became and things before that, it wants the power. You know, it goes after the power. Well,
that's
Christianity
right.
certainly did, and at times it did have all the power. So, but Hitler doesn't see that as good. He doesn't. So he was always opposed to. He wanted the church to have all its rights in its own realm of what we call the. Taking care of people's souls and so on and their spiritual life, but don't get into running the government. That's the business of the state. And he was absolutely on the side of the state. He believed in a strong state. We know that. And so that is part of his problem with the Christian churches, with
sure.
the Christian church authorities.
Sure. And, you know, to me, too, Carolyn, he made an excellent point here when he says the idea of a universal God could seem to them, meaning the Romans, only a mild form of madness. For if three people fight one another, peoples, each invoking the same God, this means that, at any rate, two of them are praying in vain. I mean, how plain spoken
yeah,
is that?
That's just basic logic.
Yeah,
you know,
God.
And that's the kind of thing that all people, when they start to question religion or whatever, they come up with things like that to say, well, wait a minute, you know, this doesn't work quite right.
Yeah, you know, God has to be not listening to the two people if three are fighting, and so what kind of God is that? He's supposed to listen to everybody. So that's why the concept of different gods made a whole lot more sense to those people. You know, my gods are stronger than your gods. If we fight this thing out, we're going to look for the guidance and help and mercy. We're going to pray for, you know, through our gods, and because we believe that our gods are more powerful than yours, and so the people that you're fighting, they're praying to their gods, you're praying to your gods, but at least everybody has the idea that God's listening to us, and then when you have this universal God, and like he says, Americans fighting Germans, British fighting Germans, or whatever, all have the same God, why should this war even be going on?
Well, that's right. And myself, personally, I don't think everybody should have the same God.
Exactly.
Because we have different goals and we're
exactly
on different
right.
paths. And so yes. why would we have the same God?
Mm-hmm.
So we're on the same page there.
Okay.
Well, let's see here. I've lost my place and I'm going back. Here it is.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, there's no timeline for 21st and 20th. No, there should be, but I guess it's coming up later. All right.
Okay. On the 21st and 22nd of October 1941 night, our special guest is Reichsfuhrer SS Himmler.
Mm-hmm.
As far as my own private existence is concerned, I shall always live simply. But in my capacity of Fuhrer and head of the state, I'm obliged to stand out clearly from amongst all the people around me. If my close associates glitter with decorations, I can distinguish myself from them only by wearing none at all.
No, I think that's really good.
Yeah.
And, of course, I've always noticed that, how he looks so plain compared to his highly decorated soldiers
sure.
and generals and so on. But he stands out that way.
Exactly. We need an impressive decor. And we ought to create one. More and more, we should give our festive occasions a style that will remain in the memory. In England, the traditional forms, which from a distance seem baroque, have retained their full youth. They remain vital because they represent customs that have been observed for a long time and without the slightest interruption. I regard it as a necessity that our ceremonial should be developed during my lifetime. Otherwise, one of my successors, if he has simple taste, could quote me as his authority. Don't speak to me of Prussian simplicity. We must remember how Frederick the Great took care of his state's finances. Besides, the Prussian spirit is a matter of character and comportment. There was a time when one could say that there was only one Prussian in Europe and that he lived in Rome. Nowadays, one can say there's only one Roman living amongst the Italians. There was a second Prussian. He lived in Munich and was myself.
Now, let's stop there because I think this requires some discussion
yes.
here. I was trying to figure out this first part, that there was only one Prussian in Europe and he lived in Rome. And I looked up some things, and then I thought there was a time. He says there was a time when one could say this. And I was thinking, I don't know what you would say, that the time he's talking of was maybe the 1920s when Mussolini was coming up and making a big impression
mm-hmm.
Before Hitler ever did
mm-hmm.
so.
Very good.
And he may be the Prussian he's thinking of living
mm-hmm.
in Rome.
Mm-hmm.
But then he says there's only one Roman, and the same Mussolini is the one Roman living among the Italians, because he often said that
mm-hmm.
that Mussolini was a true Roman, and he
yeah.
was the heir to that. And
yeah,
most of the others that were just Italians, they didn't
mm-hmm.
have that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but then and then when he says a second Prussian, and that he's speaking about himself, so he's really
sure.
identifying as a Prussian, and we know that he admired the Prussians, and he often always spoke highly of them. And of course, he thought so much of Frederick the Great,
Exactly.
Who was Prussian, and so much of what the Prussians did. But we also hear him being so identified with Munich and with Bavaria, and yet we're going to find that he's going to say something a little bit different.
That's
here.
Exactly right.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
That's
okay.
True, and he sets it out right away when he has said, Frederick the Great, and then he says the Prussian spirit is a matter of character and comportment. So that tells you right away, how he feels about that Prussian.
Spirit, yeah.
Yeah. It was one of the characteristic features of the Weimar Republic that when the head of state was receiving diplomats, he had to ask every ministry to lend him its domestic staff. What can have happened on an occasion when some ministry was holding a reception itself and couldn't spare its servants? You can see me having recourse to car hire firms to fetch my guests from their homes and take them back again. The new chancellery will have to have permanently at its disposal 200 of the finest motor cars. The chauffeurs can perform the secondary function as footmen. Whether as chauffeurs or as footmen, these men must be absolutely reliable from the political point of view, quite apart from the fact that they mustn't be clumsy fools. It's lucky we have the new Reich Chancellery. There are many things we could not have done in the old one. I've always been fond of Berlin. If I'm vexed by the fact that some of the things in it are not beautiful, it's precisely because I'm so much attached to the city. During the First World War, I twice had 10 days leave. I never dreamt of spending those leaves in Munich. My pleasure would have been spoilt by the sight of all those priests. On both occasions, I came to Berlin, and that's how I began to be familiar with the museums in the capital. Besides, Berlin played a part in our rise to power, although in a different way from Munich. It's at Berlin and Wurttemberg that I got our financial backing, and not in Munich, where the little bourgeois hold the crown of the road. What's more, Berlin has the monuments of the days of Frederick the Great. Once upon a time, it was the sandpit of the empire. Nowadays, Berlin is the capital of the Reich. Berlin's misfortune is that it's a city of very mixed population, which doesn't make it ideal for the development of culture. In that respect, our last great monarch was Frederick William, or Wilhelm IV. William I had no taste. Bismarck was blind in matters of art. William II had taste, but of the worst description. What is ugly in Berlin, we shall suppress. Nothing will be too good for the beautification of Berlin. When one enters the Reich Chancellery, one should have the feeling that one is visiting the master of the world. One will arrive there along wide avenues containing the triumphal arch, the pantheon of the army, the square of the people, things to take your breath away. It's only thus that we shall succeed in eclipsing our only rival in the world, Rome. Let it be built on such a scale that St. Peter's and its square will seem like toys in comparison. For material, we'll use granite, the vestiges of the German past, which are found on the plains to the north, are scarcely time-worn. Granite will ensure that our monuments last forever. In 10,000 years, they'll still be standing, just as they are, unless, meanwhile, the sea has again covered our plains. The ornamental theme, which we call Germano-Nordic, is found all over the earth's surface, both in South America and in the northern countries. According to a Greek legend, there is a civilization known as pre-lunar, and we can see in the legend an allusion to the empire of the lands of Atlantis that sank into the ocean. If I try to gauge my work, I must consider, first of all, that I've contributed in a world that had forgotten the notion to the triumph of the idea of the primacy of race. Secondly, I've given German supremacy a solid cultural foundation. In fact, the power we today enjoy cannot be justified, in my eyes, except by the establishment and expansion of a mighty culture. To achieve this must be the law of our existence. the means I shall set in operation to this end will far surpass those that were necessary for the conduct of this war. I wish to be a builder. A war leader is what I am against my own will. If I apply my mind to military problems, that's because for the moment I know that nobody would succeed better at this than I can. In the same way, I don't interfere in the activity of my colleagues when I have the feeling that they are performing their task as well as I could perform it myself. My reaction is that of a peasant whose property is attacked and who leaps to arms to defend his patrimony. This is the spirit in which I make war. For me, it's a means to other ends. The heroic deeds of our troops will turn pale one day. After the War of the Spanish Succession, nobody thought any longer of the 30 Years' War. The battles of Frederick the Great made people forget those of the years after 1700. Sedan took the place of the Battle of the Nations fought at Leipzig. Today, the Battle of Tannenberg and even the campaigns of Poland and the Western Front are blotted out before the battles of the East. A day will come when these battles, too, will be forgotten. But the monuments we shall have built will defy the challenge of time. The Colosseum at Rome has survived all passing events. Here, in Germany, the cathedrals have done the same. The reestablishment of German unity was Prussia's task in the last century. The present task of building Greater Germany and leading her to world power could have been successfully performed only under the guidance of a South German. To accomplish my work as a builder, I have recourse especially to men of the South. I install in Berlin my greatest architect. That's because these men belong to a region that from time immemorial has sucked the milk of civilization. My acts are always based upon a political mode of thinking. If Vienna expressed the desire to build a monument 200 meters tall, it would find no support from me. Vienna is beautiful, but I have no reason to go on adding to its beauties. In any case, it's certain that my successors won't give any city the grants necessary for such works. Berlin will one day be the capital of the world.
Well, now that was quite a wonderful monologue there, and he said so many important things that show who he was. And one of the main thing that I'd like to mention is his love for art and his belief. He even didn't want people to be in charge of things who had a sense of good art, no good taste. You know, he hated that. And he thought that if his successor would not have any sense of aesthetics and art and
culture,
yeah. Sure. then he wouldn't be too happy. But it could happen, and so he thought that he would get everything set up himself the way it should be, and then they could refer back to him. And that's why he was, I think, in such a hurry to build as much as possible, because he didn't think, he wasn't sure that after he was gone, it could be built as well as he intended, he wanted it to be built. And then, you know, he speaks here at the end about his architects being men of the South. He likes the North, but at the same time, he's talking up the South of Germany, saying that his two architects are from the South, and he's talking about first his greatest architect, Speer. Mm-hmm. Who is he there? Is this the day that he's there?
Well, he's not listed there, Carolyn.
No, that's right.
Himmler.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Himmler's here. He was there a few days before.
Right.
But Speer was he considered his greatest architect, and he was. He was born in Mannheim, which is in the Palatinate. That's where Gunter Deckard is from. And that's, you know, pretty much south, but not as far south as Giesler was his other architect, also a very gifted architect, and he was from Munich in Bavaria. So he says that these men came from a region that was more connected to the milk of civilization because it was older. It's older down there than it is further north as far as all those kind of things go. So that was interesting. And I found it, I didn't expect to hear him talk about how he prefers Berlin.
Yes.
Because generally it's thought that he liked going back to Munich, and that's where the party got hold. And it's true. You know, that's where his real following was and got started. Go ahead.
Where it was born. And, and it's interesting to me that when he says during World War One, he two times had 10 days leave, and there's no way he's going to go to Munich. He said, my pleasure would have been spoiled by the sight of all those priests. And
he's making a joke. He likes to be funny and witty.
I know it, and I thought that was really good one. And then, you know, and he also says, you know, I couldn't get the financial backing in Munich because the little bourgeois hold the crown of the road there.
Mm-hmm.
But then another very important point to make that he has done here when he says Berlin's misfortune is that it is a city of very mixed population. And this is just an affirmation that we're finding reference to so much, so very much with his thinking. And that is the primacy of race and racial unity, and that how a mixed population is going to be a very negative thing for any state. He says it doesn't make it ideal for the development of culture.
Right. And here, speaking about the culture, I found it interesting that he said the ornament. He's talking about pretty much architecture now, but. The ornamental theme, which we call Germano-Nordic, is found all over the Earth's surface in South American northern countries. Well, he goes on, but I never heard that phrase used before. But I have heard him talk about, or, you know, read him talking about the German design and German building structures, German architecture, as being more severe, more strict than the French and the Italian, but that he says that is a part of our nature, and I always liked that. I love the architecture that developed around Hitler, very very much. And I was going to use a picture of the chancellery that Albert Speer designed, and it just was so amazingly beautiful. It was totally destroyed by the Russians, but or the Soviets, I guess I'm supposed to say.
Yeah.
But, you know, I thought instead I picked out a picture of Hitler and Speer looking at some design plans, because pictures with people in them are a lot more interesting. Mm-hmm. But this is really a beautiful photograph of a hallway in the Reichschancellery that was designed by Speer. And it was used for quite a few years before 1945.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you know, kind of moving on right there is towards the end of those the passage, or maybe not quite that far, but when I was impressed when he mentions a Greek legend and talks about Atlantis. And you know, an allusion to the empire of the lands of Atlantis that sank into the ocean. I mean, you know, you talk about a well-rounded fella, and aware of so many things. It's just astonishing.
Right. You know, in that book by Otto, he remembers all these things that Hitler said. One of his chapters is when they went to a museum in somewhere south in Germany, somewhere, a museum of like history, and Hitler was just talking to the curator who was giving them a tour of the place, and he was going on and on and on about all this stuff that he had already thought about, and he was pointing things out, practically doing the tour himself, which he tended to do when he went to places like this, and he was talking about Atlantis then.
Sure.
Yeah, and that was around in sometime 1930, 31, or 32, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. So.
Also quite significant is the statement he makes, because he's been portrayed as this evil monster out to conquer the world, building this huge war machine and all that phony business. He says, a war leader is what I am against my own will. He saw the war as an unfortunate necessity that was forced upon them, but it was having to be fought. But, you know, that's the very last mm-hmm. thing. He knew it was dysgenic. He knew it was costly, but it was an unfortunate necessity. And, you know, as a war leader, I'm really against my own will. I'm only doing this because it's of necessity right now. But I'm looking forward. I am a builder. I want to be a builder. And then he goes, you know, into building Greater Germany, leading her to world power and things like this, with architecture and art and culture.
Well, right, and that's a real good place to end, Ray, mm-hmm. in
okay.
this
excellent.
Session, because this was, I think, the real tragedy. One of the real tragedies for Adolf Hitler was that his dream was to build this glorious Germany, and he was trying to do it at the same time that he was conducting
yes.
the war. But
yes.
And he was doing it until the last 2 years, as Hermann Giesler has pointed out, all non-war building and construction had to stop. The only thing that he continued with, though, was his Linz plans that Giesler was in charge of. And he continued with that because he couldn't stand not to have some architectural work going on that he could participate in, you know, at all. So that, mm-hmm. that continued. But everything else had to stop. And he always talked about when the war was over, what he was going to do and how wonderful it was going to be. He looked forward to
yes,
that.
Yes, that's right.
But the war destroyed him. And it wasn't because, as you already said, because he wanted to go to war. Mm-hmm. He didn't.
And
absolutely. It makes me feel extremely sad to a great
yes.
degree.
Oh, me too. I
yeah,
mean, that's a part of us. That's
mm-hmm.
it beckons, you know, the call of the blood, I like to call it, and it's there.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
Well, that's good. Okay, well, I think we should end here.
Oh, okay.
And we'll start next week on the 24th of October.
Okay.
And I'll do my little timeline from the 22nd next week because
okay.
it fits there better.
Good.
Okay. Well, if you've said everything you want to say,
yes, ma'am.
I'll play the outro music. So good night, ladies and gentlemen, and thanks for listening once again, and return with us next week.
Good night, folks.